Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 2, investigates allegations surrounding one of the most powerful religious figures of the 21st century, T.B. Joshua. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 4th of February, these are our main stories. A historic moment for Northern Ireland, as for the first time, an Irish nationalist has been appointed as First Minister. There have been renewed US-led airstrikes on Houthi targets in Yemen. Also in this podcast,
we've had raccoons go into the subway tunnels and interrupt subway traffic and walk right onto the subway trains. You know, they have places to go to, people to see.
But now one of the animals has caused a huge power outage in the Canadian city of Toronto. Saturday was a historic day in Northern Ireland after 2 years without a functioning government. For the first time since it was formed more than a century ago, Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom, now has a nationalist leader who wants the province to one day reunite with the Republic of Ireland. Accepting the post of First Minister in the Assembly instalment on the outskirts of Belfast, Michelle O'Neill of the pro-United Ireland party Sinn Féin pledged to serve all citizens equally, including those who want Northern Ireland to remain part of the UK.
As an Irish Republican, I pledge cooperation and genuine, honest effort with all those colleagues of a British, of a Unionist tradition who cherish the Union. This is an assembly for all, Catholic, Protestant and dissenter. Despite our different outlooks and our different views in the future constitutional position, the public rightly demand that we work together and that we deliver together.
Ms O'Neill, the region's first Catholic leader, will share power with the Deputy First Minister, Emma Little-Pengelly, from the main Protestant and Unionist party, the DUP. Ms Little-Pengelly also promised to work in the interests of all of Northern Ireland's people.
Across this chamber, we have different political viewpoints and experiences. But what we also know is that the wee mummy waiting on her cancer diagnosis is not defined as being Republican or Unionist. She is defined by the sleepless nights and worry that she may never see her children grow up. The daddy fighting to get the right educational support for his child is not defined by orange or green, but by the stress and anxiety for the future of the child they love. Let this be your inspiration, for those are the issues that we can agree on.
These people near Stormont gave their reaction to the Northern Ireland Assembly being reconvened.
It's a democratic voice of the people, you know, that Northern Ireland is governed locally, you know, and I think it's fantastic.
I'm delighted to see them back talking to each other. It's about time too.
Yeah, it's a day of hope, I would say.
I just think it's a bit funny, like, getting a fanfare because you've actually decided to show up and do a day's work for a change.
It'll probably fall apart in 5 minutes, won't it?
President Biden has welcomed the restoration of the Northern Ireland Assembly. He said he looked forward to the renewed stability that it would bring to, in his words, strengthen the peace dividend. I spoke to our political correspondent Rob Watson and asked him how big a deal this is and whether power sharing will work.
Janet, it's a very big deal. As you said, historic. I mean, after all, a state set up over 100 years ago to have a permanent Protestant pro-union majority now has, wait for it, a Catholic nationalist as First Minister. It's also a big deal because the hope is that now power sharing is back, it'll help heal some of the sectarian sensitivities stirred up by Brexit, with most Catholics having voted Remain while a majority of Protestants voted Leave. Now, will power sharing work? As you ask, it won't be easy, but Jeanette, all the parties are acutely aware that voters want them to work together and will be very angry if they don't.
Nevertheless, not every unionist is on board. How difficult a moment is this for unionism?
To see someone as First Minister who wants a united Ireland is clearly very, very difficult for unionists and unionism. But the more moderate unionists who've gone back into power sharing argue that, look, if you favour Northern Ireland staying in the UK, you have to show the current constitutional setup works. And that means making devolution and the Assembly work and, yes, working with Sinn Féin. And that argument to more hardline unionists is what exactly is the alternative? And I think the question now is whether there will be a major split in unionism or whether in the end the hardliners will get on board.
Rob Watson, the island of Ireland was partitioned in 1921. So following the developments at Stormont on Saturday, is a united Ireland on the cards? The BBC's special correspondent, Fergal Keane, worked in Northern Ireland during what were known as the Troubles, the violent conflict between nationalist and unionist communities. He now considers whether Northern Ireland is at a turning point.
What happened at Stormont, the restoration of power sharing, the election of Michelle O'Neill as First Minister, has the potential to be a transformational moment. Inevitably, in this divided place, the leaders will tell their supporters that the day means very different things. For Sinn Féin, it's part of the inexorable journey towards a united Ireland. For the Democratic Unionists, it solidifies Northern Ireland's place within the Union. So which is true? That is impossible to say, not for some years at least. The demographic shift to a Catholic majority might be seen to lend support to Sinn Féin's confidence that the end of partition is within touching distance. But that assumes all Catholics will vote to unite with the South. If power sharing is seen to work and reap economic benefits, more might be tempted to stick with the status quo rather than risk the potential instability of constitutional change. The past 2 years of drift have left many here hungry for a functioning political system. But the longer period, 26 years since the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, has seen the emergence of a more nuanced debate concerning identity, around gender and social class, for example, that complicates the old sectarian narrative. This new government is not in itself the solution, but it might just be the beginning of one.
Fergal Keane. There's been another round of US and UK airstrikes in Yemen in response to continuing Houthi attacks on commercial vessels in the Red Sea. Witnesses reported hearing explosions in the capital, Sana'a. A joint statement from the allied countries said they'd struck 36 targets linked to the Iranian-backed Houthis, hitting buried weapons storage facilities, missile launchers and air defence systems. This comes 24 hours after the US hit dozens of targets in Iraq and Syria in response to an attack by Iranian-backed militants that killed three American soldiers in Jordan last weekend. We heard more about the latest strikes on Yemen from our US correspondent, Will Vernon.
We've just had this joint statement from the US, the UK, six other countries, saying that they carried out what they called proportionate and necessary strikes against 36 Houthi targets. 13 locations in Yemen were targeted. And this, they say, was in response to the Houthis' attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. They call this additional strikes against the Houthis in Yemen. Now, it seems that this is part of the ongoing military action against the Houthi group that was launched last month. That was when the US, the UK, four other nations carried out those strikes on Houthi targets, again, to protect Red Sea shipping. Remember, this is a critical waterway. Around 15% of all world trade passed through this area before this crisis started. So it appears that this is separate from what we saw last night.
And just on that, what happened last night, President Biden is saying there will be more such strikes to come.
Yes, we are expecting more of these strikes. The White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby last night, after those airstrikes were launched, he said that there will be what he called additional responses. So I think we can expect more of the same in the coming days. But I think there's a key question here. Well, in fact, there are two key questions. The first one is, will there be an Iranian response, right? Because there was a statement earlier from the Iranians that was quite muted, I thought. But the other question is, what happens next, right? If the aim of these strikes is to deter these groups, these Iranian-backed groups, from attacking and degrade their capabilities, you know, how does Joe Biden know when he's achieved those objectives?
Will Vernon. For years, residents of Toronto have been engaged in a long-running battle with a population of raccoons who also live in the Canadian city. Some have taken up home in a bank, raided bins, or broken into the subway. Now one raccoon has single-pointedly cut power to nearly 7,000 people after, quote, making contact with equipment, according to the local power company. Sadly, that raccoon is now deceased. And as Toronto Star journalist Amy Dempsey explains, Toronto's trash pandas have a long history of getting into scrapes.
Toronto has been in a love-hate relationship with raccoons for forever. But what I learned when I started digging into newspaper archives a few years ago is that raccoon sightings in Toronto 100 years ago were a really rare event. So a raccoon in a tree would make front page news because people weren't used to seeing them here. But then slowly over time, we started to see a lot more human-raccoon conflict, and people started to realize that although they were cute, they could cause a lot of issues. So in the 1920s, a raccoon was accused of murdering 16 chickens in a backyard hen house. And by the 1950s, we see a lot of raccoons getting into garbage pails and getting garbage strewn all over people's yards. So it becomes a situation where, yes, it's cute and interesting to see one, but if you have one in your backyard, it can be troublesome.
And how problematic are they? I mean, give us a sense of the kinds of incidents that they've been involved in recently.
So a lot of the times the incidents are just funny. You know, there was a raccoon once strolling through a supermarket, just looking around. We've had raccoons go into the subway tunnels and interrupt subway traffic and walk right onto the subway trains. You know, they have places to go to, people to see. Saw a raccoon in a video the other day, just like playing with a lady's shoelaces on her shoes. They'll get into attics and make a home there. And the mating call of the raccoon is quite something. If you've never heard it, it sounds like animals are being killed. And so that is, if you have a raccoon in your attic and you hear that cry in the spring, you know that there's a raccoon up there having babies. One of the most memorable raccoon events in Toronto is our dear departed raccoon, Conrad, who was found deceased on a street one day. And the corpse wasn't picked up right away by the city. It stayed there for many, many hours. So people decided to build a memorial around the dead raccoon. They laid flowers, little notes of appreciation, and they put a framed photograph of the deceased raccoon next to him. And that stayed there for a while.
Amy Dempsey from the Toronto Star newspaper talking about raccoons to Leila Nathu. Still to come on the podcast.
Two engines, which means that should one engine fail, the aircraft is still able to continue flying on one engine. The instruments are going to be fitted in the payload bay. Other instruments are actually going to be fitted on the wingtip.
Using a drone the size of a small plane, a team of scientists will start mapping the unreached areas of Antarctica in the coming week.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. It's a story of glamour and scandal and political intrigue and a battle for the soul of a nation. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The West African country of Senegal was supposed to hold presidential elections this month, but there have been serious doubts as to whether they will be free and fair after dozens of candidates were barred from standing. Now the incumbent president, Macky Sall, has called off the race just hours before official campaigning was due to start, and it's the first time an election in Senegal has been delayed. I asked our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, if this announcement came as a surprise.
Well, it certainly would have been a surprise a few days ago, but over the last sort of 24 hours, there has been a lot of debate in the country after one of the opposition parties, the Senegalese Democratic Party, went to the National Assembly and basically tried to get a motion put forward to postpone the election. Now, it's upset because its candidate, Karim Wade, who's the son of a former president, was barred from running in the election because he has dual French and Senegalese nationality. But there have been other parties and politicians who are up in arms over the way the whole pre-election period has gone, because dozens of candidates have been prevented from running by what's called a constitutional council.
And why have they barred all these candidates from running?
Well, lots of different reasons. Some because they didn't have the required sort of paperwork and signatures. One of the most popular politicians who would have, we think, had a pretty good chance in the election, Ousmane Sonko, who was a fierce critic of President Macky Sall, he was prevented because of a legal case where he was accused of defaming a minister. So all kinds of different reasons. And then, in fact, even on Friday night, a female presidential candidate was detained by the police because there were suspicions that she also might have had dual nationality. So there was lots of controversy at this last minute. But because he hasn't even named a date, that's left it even more open to kind of, you know, what on earth happens next.
And there have been warnings from influential people in Senegal that delaying the vote like this risks destabilising the country.
Yeah, I think there'll be two camps. Some people who would say going ahead with it might have risked destabilising it because there were so many unhappy politicians and the possibility of protests and disputes. And then a prominent group of Islamic clerics, they put out a statement just before the president made his speech saying he shouldn't postpone it because that would risk destabilising the country. And it is a nation sort of surrounded by quite a lot of chaos in West Africa with lots of coups going on. Senegal has had peaceful transitions of power, but now it seems to be in the middle of, you know, what is a very messy election, and we don't know when it's going to happen.
Will Ross. The former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, and his wife Bushra Bibi have been sentenced to 7 years in jail after a court ruled their marriage was illegal and un-Islamic. In the past week, Mr. Khan has also been sentenced to 10 years in jail for leaking national secrets and 14 years for selling state gifts. Speaking outside the prison where Mr. Khan's trial was held, one of his legal team, Gohar Khan, said the former Prime Minister had not received a fair hearing.
We were not allowed to cross-examine fully the witnesses of the prosecution. We were not allowed to produce our own evidence in our defense. And that is absolutely a violation of the fundamental rights that were guaranteed by the Constitution. And we hope that we will file an appeal before Islamabad High Court. We are very much hopeful that this conviction will be set aside and sentences will also be set aside, inshallah ta'ala.
With just days to go before elections are due to be held in Pakistan, our correspondent there, Caroline Davies, explained why this sentence had been imposed on Mr. Khan now.
This particular sentence relating to his marriage to his wife, Bushra Bibi. This is his third wife. Now, this case was brought by her ex-husband that she was married to for around 30 years. And he says that Bushra Bibi and Imran Khan did not wait the designated period of time in between his divorce from Bushra Bibi and Imran Khan's marriage that is mandated by Islam. That is why, in the course of this judgment, the judge has also talked about it being un-Islamic as well as being illegal. This is the third jail sentence that Imran Khan has got in the course of a week. And the backdrop to all of this, of course, is that there are general elections that are scheduled to be held this coming Thursday. This isn't just about adding on an extra jail sentence to many of Imran Khan's supporters. What they think is happening here is that there is a repression of Imran Khan and of his political party in the build-up to those general elections, that what is often referred to as the establishment here in Pakistan, that is the military and the intelligence services, they think they are trying to repress Imran Khan. They are trying to put voters off voting for him in the run-up to those general elections. Of course, the authorities here deny that and say that these are sort of absurd allegations against them. What is particularly interesting about this case is that some people have said that this is also about trying to show or trying to undermine Imran Khan's religious credentials. That since Imran Khan had a religious reawakening, that has been a crucial part of his political campaigning, and suggesting that his marriage is un-Islamic, they suggest, will try potentially to undermine his credibility with voters to whom that is really important.
Caroline Davies in Pakistan. To Germany now. Where protesters have taken to the streets across the country in mass demonstrations against the far-right AfD party. A co-leader of the Social Democratic Party, Saskia Esken, said the demonstrators wanted to send an unequivocal message to the AfD.
I want to make it very clear that the civil society is sending out a signal here, that the civil society is standing up, opening its mouth and making it clear that the AfD will never gain power in this country. We will all take a clear stand against it.
Our correspondent in Berlin, Damien McGuinness, told us more about the protests.
This is the third weekend in a row that mass demonstrations have been held in towns and cities right across Germany. They're being held by all sorts of groups, from environmentalists, trade unions, political parties, even a group called Grannies Against the Far Right. What they all have in common is they're protesting against right-wing extremism after reports of a secret meeting in November attended by the far-right party, the AfD, at which a plan was discussed to deport anyone with non-German heritage outside of Germany. Would affect millions of people. A very radical plan which is not going to happen, but it shocked the whole nation, sparked these mass demonstrations. Now, as a result, over the last few weeks, the AfD has seemed to have slipped in the polls to just under 20%. It could be because of these protests putting off some people, or it could be because other far-right parties and anti-migrant groups are being set up, undermining support for the AfD. Either way, AfD leaders have come out fighting. They say they're being victimised by mainstream German politics and media, and they hope that actually these protests will boost their support by playing into this narrative they often use, that they're being victimised by the rest of German society.
Damien McGuinness in Berlin. Before we move on, here's a message from Oliver Conway.
Just a quick reminder that we are looking for your questions about the current state of the war in Ukraine for a special edition of the Global News Pod to mark the second anniversary of the invasion. We'll get answers from the team at Ukrainecast. So if you are wondering whether some in Ukraine would be willing to sacrifice occupied territory for peace, or what's the impact of so many young men from Russia being killed in Ukraine, then please email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or tweet at Global News Pod. And if possible, record your question as a voice note. Thank you.
A team of scientists and engineers will start mapping the unreached areas of Antarctica in the coming week using a drone that is the size of a small plane. It's been designed and tested in the UK, and the researchers hope the findings will help them predict how long it will take for ice sheets to melt and the impact that will have on climate change. Here's Georgina Ranard.
Scientists are desperate to know more about Antarctica and climate change, but two things are getting in the way. One, it's incredibly dangerous to work there. The second barrier is, scientific work has to be precise, repetitive, and even, can I say it, boring. When might glaciers melt, and how fast? And when they do, how big will the rise in sea levels be? Scientists need kit that works whatever the weather, and this might be the solution. It's a drone. No, not one of those small ones that buzz overhead in the park. This one has two propellers and wings spanning the length of two cars. It can fly up to 1,000 kilometres in one go and needs a fraction of the fuel a traditional plane uses. I went to see it in action. I've come to Llanbedr in North Wales where it's windy, there's dark rain clouds overhead. It's the perfect conditions for engineers to test this drone that will face the fierce winds and 24-hour darkness of Antarctica. It's the brainchild of the British Antarctic Survey and UK company Windracers. It can be programmed to do the same thing over and over again, experiments that pilots might get tired of. All it needs is an engineer to oversee it at a computer. In Antarctica, that engineer will be Rebecca Toomey.
So you can see two engines there, which means that should one engine fail, the aircraft is still able to continue flying on one engine.
It's been kitted out to survey ice sheets and count wildlife.
The instruments are going to be fitted in the payload bay. Other instruments are actually going to be fitted on the wingtips.
Those instruments will be used by Tom Jordan.
We'll be surveying using the Pinotta aircraft.
In the past, he used the British Antarctic Survey's piloted planes. Now he's gone to Antarctica again with a fresh wish list. He'll run the first experiments with the new drone.
On that side of the island, there's a big local ice sheet.
Tom is talking about the Fuchs-Piedmont ice sheet. Radar on the drone will fire pulses of radio waves at it.
And some of it will reflect, but some of it will actually go into the ice sheet and it go all the way down, hit the rock at the base, bounce back, and the drone will be listening for those reflections coming back.
Those reflections will help Tom understand how thick the ice is and how tall the mountains are underneath. The drone can survey at 1 kilometre intervals, much more precise than in the past. This drone won't stop Antarctica's ice melting, but it could give us knowledge that helps us prepare for our planet's future.
Georgina Runard reporting. Wayne Kramer, one of the founders of the pioneering American rock band MC5, has died at the age of 75 from pancreatic cancer. The Detroit band, formed in the 1960s, is seen as a template for punk rock. MC5's best-known single is Kick Out the Jams. Sean Wales looks back at the life of the widely admired rock guitarist.
When Wayne Kramer and MC5 released Kick Out the Jams in 1969, they didn't do so aiming for it to be a politically charged anthem. They were simply referring to boring bands, telling them to get off the stage. Kick out the jams! Kick out! But with their fierce guitar riffs and anti-establishment platform, MC5 became synonymous with political demonstrations, performing for thousands of protesters outside the 1968 US Democratic National Convention. They only ever released one live album and two studio albums before breaking up. Nevertheless, the band is seen as laying the groundwork for the punk rock scene. Kramer was sentenced to 4 years in jail on drugs charges in 1975 and returned to the music scene in the 1990s. Just last year, he announced plans to release a third MC5 studio album titled Heavy Lifting. Among those paying tribute to Wayne Kramer was former collaborator Tom Morello, guitarist with Rage Against the Machine, who wrote MC5 basically invented punk rock music, and brother Wayne Kramer was the best man I've ever known.
Sean Wales on the life of MC5 guitarist Wayne Kramer, who has died at the age of 75. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Javed Gilani. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.